Happy New Year, everybody. It's the year of the fire horse, and I'm here with Abigail Susek, an art historian, vice president of the International Society for the Study of Surrealism, and editor of Resurgence, Jonathan Leake, Radical Surrealism and the Resurgence Youth Movement, 1964 to 1967. And I mentioned the fire horse because it's the year of the horse and the first year of the fire horse in 60 years, since 1966.
Totally. I'm a fire dragon, so I think I have 13 more years to go. I'm just waiting. But fire horse seems like it could be a good one.
I don't know much about astrology at all, including Chinese astrology, but I was looking into it on Reddit because I'm China maxing, you know, that's the new trend. And it says that the year of the fire horse is a year of fire, energy, passion, enthusiasm, movement, combined with the energy of the horse. This is amplified at an almost chaotic pace. And there's a lot of theories about the year of the fire horse setting into motion the most turbulent times of the 60s and around the world. So I thought it was maybe an appropriate way to start moving back to the 60s mindset, like we like to do on this Armed Love, this wreckage vertical. So yeah, we want to work our way towards the 60s, talking about the Resurgence Youth Movement, which was an anarchist group in New York, and some of the other surrealist currents of the 60s. Before we get there, I want to work all the way back from the beginning of surrealism and even starting with Dada, because this is something I've always been interested in, the political nature of the avant-garde of art in general and why it was so important to revolutionaries in the interwar period, and maybe trying to understand this re-encounter with it in the 60s.
Yeah, that's a big history. And in a way, you know, if you're talking about surrealism, which I want to clarify is aggressively international movement, I wouldn't use the word global because it's not everywhere, but it is in many countries and it is still going on today. Believe it or not, there are living surrealist groups in various nations. And you know, it's about 100 years old, right? The official start date is 1924 of the surrealist movement. Although that word surrealism is a neologism that is coined before that in 1918, actually, you know, at the very end of the war by a soldier, a Guillaume Apollinaire. But Dada predates that, and like surrealism, it is a self-named group, right? So many of these isms, as you probably know, were pejorative names that were slapped on by critics, and then sometimes movements adopted them, like Impressionism is a name that was given by a critic in critiquing, you know, those artists, you know, starting in the 1870s, and then that name becomes adopted. But Dada and surrealism are both self-elected names. And I mean, I think both of those movements can be understood as part of one another, right? So, you know, we're always talking about proto-surrealism or kind of the time before surrealism, which is really Dada, especially in Paris. But in a way, Dada folds into surrealism. I wouldn't want to make them completely inseparable. I wouldn't say that surrealism devours Dada, but I also don't think that surrealism could have happened without Dada. Surrealism is like deeply indebted to several movements that came before, and most closely Dada, as you probably know. And, you know, so Dada starts in Zurich in 1916, and it's a direct result of World War I. And then very quickly after that, you have Dada popping up in other cities, in Berlin, in Germany, of course, in Hanover, then in Paris and New York, almost simultaneously.
Result of World War One, it was founded by people who went to Switzerland to avoid the war.
Totally,
Hanging out with Lenin, and you know, in a very small area.
Yeah, Lenin is hanging out there in Zurich. James Joyce is there, and those original Zurich Dadas are an international group. A lot of Romanian Jews, in particular, Tristan Tzara and Marcel Janco, but also Germans coming in. Hugo Ball, really key to that group, who actually had signed up for the war on the German side, goes to the front in Belgium to fight and is so horrified by, you know, the carnage he sees, having been a PhD in philosophy, essentially. He deserts, this treason, and has to literally run away. And he creates fake passports with Emmy Hennings, his partner, former prostitute. And you know, they come, and then there are others as well, Swiss, French, etc., who are part of the group, multilingual in that regard, like really aggressively multilingual. So they're, you know, I don't know if I would want exactly to use the word refugees, some of them, but they're certainly fleeing the war or deserting the war, and trying to find that neutral space, and then also opposing the war. And there are curfews, there are food rations going on in Zurich. So, you know, the kind of, if we want to talk about the political side of that, it's, we have to understand it within that time frame when, you know, they have lights out at, you know, at a certain time. You know, even though Switzerland is neutral, I think that they're, you know, concerned about being in the middle of everything. So, and I can expand on that. But of course, the most political moment of Dada is in Berlin, and that coincides with the revolution there at that time. And some of the members of sort of some of the German Dadaists are, you know, intensely politicized and to the point where they're in danger.
So one of my favorite texts about Dada is Greil Marcus's Lipstick Traces, with connecting Dada with punk. And I think what he really highlights there is the transgressiveness of it. Transgression almost for its own sake, iconoclasm, taking art forms, poetry, plastic arts, theater, and trying to make it as shocking and unpleasant and as strange as possible. I see it as connecting to this feeling that people had when they saw the war coming. You know, maybe they were socialists or whatever. The entirety of Europe, it gets into this war fever, and it just plays out in this senseless bloodshed. And so often in museums or modern art retrospectives of these movements, they say, well, these people were shell-shocked, and they had like PTSD, and that's why this art was so fragmented and violent and strange. But to me, it seemed almost like a strategy for dealing with living in a society that seems to be falling apart in these senseless, awful ways.
Yeah, totally. What's interesting is there seem to be, and I'm kind of running through my memories here, actually not so many of the Dadaists were soldiers, which is, you know, actually were on the front of World War One, whereas a lot of the Surrealists were. And yet, I mean, Hugo Ball was, as I said, he saw some action, and I believe that Hans Arp did as well, who was also associated with Surrealism. He's sort of from northern, what, you know, became northern France, essentially, Alsace-Lorraine. But you do see it in the German Dada group really, really clearly because of that November Revolution, 1918-19, which is right on the heels, of course, of the, in Germany losing the war, where you have like John Hartfield in particular, and I would say Raoul Hausmann, and some others who are literally, and I mean, it's certainly Hannah Hirsch, if you know her work, with the famous montage Cut with a Kitchen Knife, has a very long title. I'm not going to say the whole title, but, you know, using montage, whether, you know, kind of an extreme fragmentation of images of politicians and famous figures from Germany and elsewhere, where the fragment becomes so aggressively cut, like as if with a kitchen knife, like stabbed is the title of that work, I believe from 1919, or montages that are, you know, actually so refined, like those of John Hartfield, where the cut of found images from the newspaper, et cetera, is sort of disguised so that you have, you know, Adolf Hitler being turned into a monster or something like this. You know, so what I'm talking about is like either extreme fragmentation in a montage or a seamless, almost kind of Photoshopped look, in order to make the satire more aggressive. But that kind of ballistics, visual ballistics that could be related to like a shell shock aesthetic, because of course that term shell shock originates with World War One. It's like the first war where we really have that kind of extensive bombardment in terms of the technology, I think is absolutely connected to the knowledge of the unbelievably destructive forces going on in World War One. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 40 million, well, they're still estimating it, safely 20 million, including civilian casualties, not including the pandemic fatalities that happened, you know, in 1918-19 with the influenza.
When the war is over, Dada has, through scandal and through kind of being influential in the European art underground, has become sort of... like everyone had to choose what side they're on. If you're like cutting edge artist in Europe, is this the moment where we get the idea of a political artistic avant-garde?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, I love tracing that idea back because it really kind of helps me get a sense of, like, you know, the various options we have now, let's say, or, you know, the sort of practicalities of this and prior examples. And not really, actually. I mean, you could take it probably really far back if you wanted, especially if you went into different contexts. But I mean, I really would say that France is the beginning of the avant-garde in that sense. And that term, remember, is actually a military term. Mm-hmm. Avant-garde is the front line, right? So the people who are going to run out in front and get shot first. I think that's really important when we talk about the avant-garde. And then that word was adopted by a utopian socialist named Saint-Simon, who was an aristocratic, essentially a wealthy French intellectual in the early 19th century. And he adopts it, you know, trying to talk about the avant-garde or the front line or the prefigurative horizon of a better socialist society. This is before Marx. And it's from him that the French avant-garde and related groups elsewhere in Europe pick up that term and use it. But, you know, artistically, I mean, certainly in the French Revolution with people like Jacques-Louis David, who was painting for the king, and then a couple of years later is voting for the, you know, the execution of the king and queen, you know, a rabid revolutionary working for the Jacobins, but certainly people like Courbet, you know, in the 1840s and 50s, who is a socialist and is, as you might know, I mean, it's a book I wish I could write. I think it's already been written by T.J. Clark, but I'd like to rewrite it about, you know, Courbet is one of the leaders in the Commune Revolution in 1870-71, you know, which is a coup d'etat that was very short-lived. But he, you know, his politics made him, like David, essentially a traitor to the state. And then just briefly, I'll say, you know, there are other politicized people in the, certainly many of them in France at the end of the 19th century, and we could definitely talk about other countries, but what really inspires, let's say, the French surrealist group starting in the teens is the prior example of the symbolists, some of whom were very fierce anarchists. And it is that anarchist discourse that is very, obviously the socialist one as well, or Marxist, as we might say today, communist. So, you know, these terms were a little bit interchangeable more at that time. But the anarchist discourse is really sharp in France. This is a lot of publications coming out, et cetera. And the symbolists are taking that in, and particularly like André Breton, this famous co-founder of the Paris Surrealist group, is really deeply influenced by that current of symbolism, which is not that well known. So, but just to try to answer your question, I do think that in terms of like the avant-gardisms, impressionism, cubism, certainly fauvism, futurism is a different story, that Dada is the most politicized in the sense that we might think of that today in a non-fascist way, because futurism kind of leans in that direction.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned T.J. Clark and sort of reminded me of, were you talking about Farewell to an Idea?
I was talking about his book on Courbet, but Farewell to an Idea is a very important text as well. I forget the title of the book on Courbet.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember reading his essay in that book about the painting The Death of Marat, and I think he claimed that was where the avant-garde is invented because of the use of text in the painting and its connection to the French Revolution. You know, and he was using that to sort of transition to talking about constructivism and Bolshevik avant-garde art. It also always, along those lines, it also always fascinated me that the futurists, who I guess are mostly post-World War I movement, that's when it begins. In Italy, they become fascists, but in Russia, they become Bolsheviks. And the two groups were friends with each other. They just both like... sort of through their fetishism of the new, of technology, of the machine, join the revolution on totally opposite sides.
Yeah. It's such a crazy history in that way. I mean, you see it all over the map, especially in the 20th century, people who start out on the far left or the ultra left, depending on which word you want to use for which period, you know, and then become fascist or completely right-wing. We see it in the 60s as well, to some degree, with people who might be associated with, you know, what was formerly called the neo-avant-garde after World War II, which is the term I don't enjoy at all. But the Clark book on Courbet is called Image of the People. That's the...
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, that's the Marat thing is an interesting question because, right, I mean, it's essentially that's a kind of propaganda. you know, for the revolution. And so it raises that question of, again, kind of what would be the particular avant-garde modality of, you know, creating radicalism via the work of art, right? And what is the fine line between propaganda and not propaganda, right? And so I would actually, I mean, I'm a big fan of David, but I would fight against that a little bit in the sense that, I mean, obviously that the image of Marat murdered in the bathtub, you know, by a sort of a counter-revolutionary different faction is, you know, evocative, deeply emotional, and an amazing work of art. I'm not saying that, but it is, I think I would lean it in the direction of propaganda because of its sort of unwavering support of a particular political program and its over the top kind of apology for this writer, Marat, who was a Jacobin.
I might be selling T.J. Clark's argument short there. I'm just kind of like going from memory. But these questions I'm circling around to set us up for like more contemporary and 60s stuff is, you know, what is it about Dada, and then we'll talk about surrealism, that makes it so politically relevant? Because I think, like, especially today, the world of art is just seen as this totally elite, high society, commodified space that's like mostly money laundering for the ultra wealthy. And of course, there's a lot of artists that are always going to be involved in radical movements. But I think a lot of people see like a very strong separation between that, especially that element of the cultural sphere, and like working class struggle or what happens in the streets. So, what was it about like avant-garde art in the interwar period that was so relevant that you have the futurist being part of these important political movements, and then we'll move on to the surrealists?
Yeah. I mean, it's so easy, like if you study, if you take an art historical lens and look at this stuff, to just be like, damn, everything became a high commodity. Like, you know, everything is recuperated into the museum. Everything's in the history book. And so it's like a wash. It's a failure, you know. And then maybe I'm still thinking about Clark here and Farewell to an Idea, right? And this idea of the kind of death of modernism's aspirations. But we don't have to take that lens. And that's a sort of, as I, you know, I am technically disciplined by the discipline of art history. That's kind of what I teach and do. But I really like these days to reapproach art history through not just like a social art history, as they've called it, or, you know, but actually, you know, with some more sociological concepts, where I'm thinking about group formation and movement formation, certainly in terms of movement building, in terms of how people, groups of people, small and large, can create, you know, or create social change, resist, et cetera, how people make history happen and not just the objects, right? That's kind of counterintuitive that you would do that with art history, but you know, really, like, back to that Zurich Dada moment, I mean, these are people who they don't have jobs, they're fleeing their countries, whether it's because of anti-Semitism in Romania and other threats there. You know, the passport is this like new thing. Some of them don't even have passports yet in this period in 1916. And they just put an ad in the newspaper, you know, spend a little bit of money, and they meet in this crappy basement cafe. I think it was great what they did, but, you know, they just get this guy to agree. And it's like literally a small affinity group of just a few people. And they start by having entertainment. You know, people just come and drink and they carouse, and it's not, you know, something that's sort of revolutionary exactly. And that, you know, in Berlin, I think it's more explicitly politicized, but I think that's relevant right now. Like the idea of escaping perhaps, or moving into territories where you can meet safely, or, you know, if you're able to do that, or going to places where the affinity group can be formed and its movements aren't fully surveilled constantly, doing activities that seem kind of innocuous, like playing the piano and singing, you know, whereas actually, you know, you're dressed maybe as a pope or a bishop spewing nonsense, you know, critiquing, let's say, the power of religion. So, you know, and then in Berlin, they toe the line a little bit more, the Dadaists, like with a little bit more danger, in the sense of they have small exhibitions, and then they have like a dummy, an effigy of a German cop with a pig face, like, you know, slung from the ceiling, or Hartfield is circulating these handmade images. The good thing about the montage is, you don't necessarily know who the artist is. You're just using found images that were already there in the media. So like, what are you going to do? You know? So I think these kind of, these things that actually can kind of fly under the radar a little bit and are analog, in person, intimate to some degree, and innocuous, even sort of silly, are very helpful.
Yeah, like I said, Dada, just reading Greil Marcus, it just reminds me so much of punk and the idea of these happenings, or like where the poet is actually screaming at you, is actually trying to offend you, is actually trying to wake you up or jostle you in some way. So if that's punk, I sort of think of surrealism as, I don't know, like prog rock or something like that, or post-punk, I don't know, or like Fugazi maybe. Not that they were surrealists, but it seems to be something that comes after it that sort of tries to zero down into this more subconscious level of creativity. I'll quote André Breton's Surrealist Manifesto from 1924. He defines surrealism as the belief in the superior reality of certain forms of previously neglected associations, in the omnipotence of the dream, in the disinterested play of thought. It tends to ruin once and for all other psychic mechanisms and to substitute itself for them in solving all the principal problems of life. So, you know, this was written as a manifesto. I think Dada also had a few manifestos. And the surrealists would become, I think, at least for their initial period, very politically aligned with the revolutionary left. It's such an interesting statement to connect to a revolutionary project, because we're talking about the omnipotence of dreaming, the disinterested play of thought. Like, what did that mean to them politically, and how did they connect it to, like, the workers' movement?
Yeah, I mean, it's... This is the hardest question with surrealism, and why my teachers, like Benjamin Buchlow in particular, were always wonderfully suspicious of surrealism. You know, certainly like compared with Bolshevik art currents, like constructivism, and I think very understandably so. And I actually really like to go to someone like Deleuze, when he thinks about surrealism, where he does in various places in the middle of the 20th century, and he kind of talks about like the inner fascist that we all have. And so, you know, this idea that there could be an interior front or an interior struggle on the individual level, atomized, that then could connect to or even serve the exterior struggle, whether it's sort of political or party-based with the state form or not, is not an easy jump to make, you know, and it is fraught with difficulties and failures. And so I think that question is still not answered, and that we could talk about it in a number of ways, but it's a really different approach than, I mean, I think it was there a little bit in Dada, depending on which of the Dada cities that you're talking about. I think in particular in Zurich, it's there, this kind of interiority, right? This is the famous ARP who is also flirting with surrealism very quickly. But in 16, he's like tearing up, you know, pieces of colored paper and letting them fall to the ground, wherever they land, with gravity, the sort of chance of gravity, the sort of natural force, this quite mystical in a way, is where they're glued down. You know, so it, some of that, I don't want to call it sort of mystical, but kind of an interior understanding, certainly with Hugo Ball as well, is there. So it's not coming out of nowhere for them. But then the important thing to remember, Andy, is that, as you probably know, the Paris Surrealist group, which is the first group that names themselves, they take the name from Apollinaire. There's a kind of battle going on over surrealism, this word. Another guy has a group called Yvan Gol in Paris. Eventually they give up on using the term, and, you know, Breton and Aragon, Navi, Elouard, these are early, and Simon Breton, key members, early members, you know, kind of get the word. But they, many of them are veterans of World War I, quite a few of them on the front. In particular, a couple of them are doctors like Breton, who are treating on the front shell-shocked soldiers, both ones who are really shell-shocked and they don't understand PTSD yet, that's their early word, and those who are possibly faking psychosis to get out of the, you know, unbelievable horror of the trench warfare. So they're seeing this firsthand, you know, the extent, the interior and exterior extent of the violence and carnage.
And there's a pretty heavy Freudian influence on it as well, right? Like this idea that so much of how society functions can be understood through going into individual psychologies, individual neuroses, dream states, etc. And Freud was an immensely political writer. People don't really give him enough credit for that. I guess in terms of the surrealists who, for example, I know a lot of them ended up in the Trotskyist Fourth International. I think some of them were a bit more anarchistic. Some of them were Stalinists. how did they see the applying the surrealist form to political struggle?
Yeah, I'm just going to go back for a second to the kind of war context, because, you know, the ones who are studying medicine who abandon that career, by the way, right, they're kind of like mostly middle class, some upper middle class bourgeois people pursuing professional careers, but they abandon their careers. And but those who are studying are getting Freud through the French sources. They're French teachers, essentially, who were also really important in the formation of psychoanalysis, the continuation of the building of psychology as a field. But remember, like, you're studying that, you're 18, you're a soldier, and it's in the direct context of people, you know, whose faces are being blown off, like, you know, or who lose the power of speech or have complete amnesia, you know, severe psychosis because of the war, and particularly the technology associated with the war, the use of the airplane, mustard gas for the first time, and heavy artillery that exceeds what had been used in the late 19th century by far. So, like, I think already there, like, it would be false to say, and you're right to say about Freud, but not you, but like in general, if you would be like, oh, it's just about psychology and the mind, it's not, because they're already seeing how the mind and body of individual humans are, you know, or can be obviously destroyed, but, you know, transformed into fighting machines, you know, crushed into, you know, barely living forms. And so it's just right, always right there for them. And it takes a minute for that to connect to a particular political movement. I mean, they're interested by 1921, the people who, this is again before surrealism, right? It's officially becomes a movement and a group in 1924. But by 1921, those key members are already thinking about socialism. They're talking to people about it. And interested in it. And then once as they form in 24, and by 25, they're already making, you know, very aggressive movements as a group to join the French Communist Party. And that's a long story. Yes, you have kind of every like possible iteration of what a leftist could look like coming out of that long movement, right? So you have aggressive Trotskyists like Benjamin Perret, who also goes to fight with the Durruti column in Spain during the revolution, right? You have, you know, people who are become hardline communists and never let it go and abandon surrealism, like Aragon. He becomes a Stalinist and abandons surrealism in the early 30s. Others abandon it later, like Paul Eluard. They're happy remaining in the PCF, the French Communist Party, despite Stalin. You know, others like Breton say, you know, They break with Stalin's communism.
And his insistence on socialist realism as well.
Totally.
We can kind of think of it as like the opposite of the avant-garde.
Well, yeah, that comes back to that question of propaganda. So that's in like 36, when there's a specific moment in which they break because of Stalin's authoritarianism, you know, and it's becoming really clear what's happening there to that state, that new state form, and that government and everything, but also certainly, yeah, this idea that art has to serve the purpose of the revolution in an explicitly, you know, a kind of curtailed way, a programmatic way, and the surrealists say, actually, no, we don't want, it's not just a refusal, we don't want to do that, we don't want to be disciplined, we don't want to follow your rules, it's actually on principle, that that art that would be an art of revolution, an art of liberation and emancipation, specifically not do that, right? Could not serve in that way. And that's a point that was never, I mean, there's people are still fighting about it. So,
well, maybe jumping to the post-war period, the situationist critique of surrealism, the situationists also come out of the avant-garde art world, the letterist movement that was sort of a post-surrealist international, I guess. When they're sort of breaking in from letterism into situationism, they write this. The surrealist program, asserting the sovereignty of desire and surprise and proposing a new way of life, is much richer in constructive possibilities than is generally realized. The limited scope of surrealism was in large part due to the lack of material means for fulfilling its aims. Sort of getting to the question we just covered. Another quote from the same piece. The unconscious was the finally discovered ultimate force of life. And the fact that the surrealists revised the history of ideas in accordance with that simplistic perspective and never went any further. So I understand this critique to mean that they uncovered the importance of the, you know, this deep-seated creativity that all people have, that all workers could unleash and change the world through collective action, not through simply taking over the means of production as they currently exist and running it through a new socialist party or something, but actually taking over the world and rebuilding it in this this creative way that avant-garde art could give us a vision of like how different things could be. That's how I sort of understood it. And then the critique is, well, they had this vision and it was influential in political circles, but they were never able to really do anything because they were still sort of in this cultural sphere separated from everyday life.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, this is sort of a weird thing to say, but I think you can totally understand surrealism or its impact unless you look at the situationist critique, which is also, as you know, the quote that you gave us shows that it is a critique that's also embedded in a kind of deep study and understanding, right? So it's almost like the critique of the student who has a great teacher, right? The student will always be formed by the teacher and their work will be informed by it, even while they might break with that teacher. I mean, that's a sign of a good, you know, student-teacher relationship. And I really enjoy that. Like, you know, for me, détournement, as I argue, is this French word détournement, which the situationist family uses, rerouting or hijacking found material, transforming it into something that is a completely different purpose, whether it's an object or an image. The surrealists are using this word already in the late 1920s, and the situationists are consciously appropriating and detourning the détournement from surrealism. But it's really hard to answer and with enough nuance, because I think that the thought of the French situationists and Debord and other situationists is really important. And we're still wrapping our heads around it. But I will say that I think that for me, what that critique comes down to with them is actually that in the end, we have to give up art. You know, that art is an entity that is from the capitalist structure, the capitalist superstructure, and that you know, we need to move into actually even more radical understandings of the kind of non-capitalist activity and subjectivity that would be necessary to create the conditions of revolution, and then actually do it, right? Like I would say that really, at least at some point in the 60s, certainly with 68, May 68, that the situationists were ready for, like many other revolutionaries were at this time, for an actual revolution and whatever avenue that would come through, cultural or political. So for the SI, the surrealists fail. And I'm really fascinated in this sort of failure. I think about it a lot lately. I'm thinking about words like despair and disappointment, failure. This links me to some of what Clark was saying in the book that you mentioned, and as we confront what we're confronting right now. And I think that was always there right after the war for the surrealists, this sort of what Pierre Navi called organization of pessimism, or maybe activation of disappointment and despair. But for the SI, it doesn't quite get there, and yet they can't fully move away from it, right? And then what does the SI do? Like, right? They're when we have to confront that the 60s is, it's especially right now, I've been thinking lately that that the 60s is still happening. Like what mm-hmm. we're seeing right now here in 2026 to me feels actually like an extension of the struggles of the 60s, or maybe even a backlash.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I do these episodes about the 60s, is because I think, you know, there's a lot of discourse about, you know, the failures of the new left, and like, how do we move on from the new left? How do we go back to something earlier or do something new? And really, I think we haven't, the new left hasn't ended. Like we're still all kind of a part of it. And, the Situationist critique, which comes in the late 50s, critiquing an early resurgence of surrealism. I'm not sure exactly who they were talking to. I think they're trying to lay down that there's a crisis in avant-garde art since the war. And you know, one story I always think of related to this is Man Ray, who was a Dadaist. Made this, had a ready-made called Object to be Destroyed, which is like a metronome with a picture of an eye on it. And the idea was that it would be exhibited and then smashed at the gallery. After the war, Man Ray's and a lot of the Dadaists are very successful artists. And Man Ray exhibits Object to be Destroyed, and a sort of neo-Dadaist or surrealist comes and destroys it at the gallery. And this causes a big scandal, and Man Ray is so upset that he makes hundreds of these to sell them to galleries and museums all over the world, which I think perfectly speaks to the critique that the Situationists are making, which is that if this stuff is so respected and it's able to be exhibited all over the world as just this memory of a revolutionary moment in history and in art, then what's the point of it anymore? It's not surprising. It's not shocking. It doesn't change the way anyone thinks. And so they start to think about, well, if we want art to be if we want avant-garde art to be possible again, we actually need to revolutionize the world. The question isn't now about making society surreal and unreal in this way that seemed possible in the 20s, but in actually making revolt, making the sort of rationalizing revolt that will make poetry and art possible afterwards. That's how they always framed it.
Yeah, that's a great example. I don't actually know that Man Ray story. I mean, I know the object, but that's very cool. I think it's a great illustration. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I just want to talk to that last point that you made, that I think if it's easier to understand that the Surrealist Project was about consciousness, and about the possibility of another life that they believed was possible, even if right now it's not accessible, right? And so I'm very interested in this word prefiguration in general for then and now, for surrealism and way beyond that. We can talk about that word prefiguration. It has to do with a kind of multiple temporality that Walter Benjamin saw as one of the most promising aspects of surrealism when he writes about it starting in the 1920s. He's obsessed with surrealism, and Benjamin says it's, you know, in 1929 he says it is the viable path for revolutionary, you know, for art that is not just art and revolution, but revolutionary art. But, you know, this is why I think, you know, we're talking about surrealism as a sort of set of concepts as well as a broad social movement. Only recently, like, have art historians been like, hey, there's actually surrealism still going on after World War II, and it doesn't die in 1966 with Breton. So what about post-World War II surrealism, and even beyond that, contemporary surrealism? And so we start to see younger generations who are not necessarily just surrealists, but people who are actually revolutionaries, or, you know, like, ultra-leftist radicals from various spectra of leftism who are in not just sort of invoking surrealism in their tracts, their zines, their actions, their artworks, their happenings, their, you know, protest actions, etc., but are channeling it. And you see this in May 68, right? So that's a sort of famous, if you're a surrealism scholar, a surrealist rebuttal. Well, in 68, the students sprayed, you know, surrealist slogans from on the walls. Yeah, but it's way beyond that. Like, this is that larger question of also, how does the old left relate to the new left, right? what is the purpose of the avant-garde now? Why is this kind of dumbed down, like art-specific concept of the neo-avant-garde, which someone named Peter Berger talked about in the 70s, which, you know, is quite complex, but it's just not enough. Like, there's a larger question here, especially if we admit that the struggle for to not let this capitalist system like completely destroy the world and, you know, create humans like standing reserve to be used and killed at will is not going to stop. I mean, you know, so I just think that that like the kind of continual disappointments are actually fuel to the fire about just that the inability to ever stop resisting. I'm not trying to sound like an inspirational speaker, but I find that to be actually a really important part in that story.
Well, yeah. And so the Situationists, I think they're one of their major political contributions into, you know, what would become the New Left was that they understood very early on that riots, like urban riots and wildcat strikes, were revolutionary activity. That's something that obviously everyone kind of can debate today, but that's a known idea. In 2020, you had average liberals defending looting and that kind of thing. But in the, if you were a leftist in the 50s and the 60s, these were considered wrong. They're undisciplined. You know, you were going against the PCF controlled unions in a lot of cases. Very few people saw the Watts riots in LA, for example, as anything revolutionary besides the Situationists. I mean, black radicals in the United States understood this, but people in Europe, not so much. So I think that's a good way of connecting what the Situationist critique was to the resurgence of surrealism in the United States. And there's also a common thread there with Raya Dunayevskaya, who was a post-Trotskyist, part of the Johnson Forest tendency, who seemed to have been meeting with some of the neo-surrealists in Chicago and in New York, right? So
yeah, it's like, it's such a rich area of study to think about kind of like, I don't know, I want to say like the shreds of surrealism or the capillaries. I mean, you know, the French surrealist group does, the Paris surrealist group does keep going. And there are other surrealist groups around the world at this point in the 60s and the 50s. But actually what I found really rewarding is to try to figure out why people who are not actually part of a surrealist group, who are really like committed to action in terms of stopping Vietnam, you know, of civil rights, unrest, certainly, but also black power to the fullest extent. So to understand the extended story of surrealism's relevance for resistance praxis, it's actually easiest to look to individuals who may not have necessarily been part of surrealist groups, although there were certainly people like Aimé Césaire in Martinique, you know, who he did consider himself a surrealist, you know, and it was sort of very, very clearly linked to, you know, a broadly applicable horizon of resistance. But I was mentioning people like Ben Maria, an American radical, you know, and
former guest on the show.
Yes. Great. Okay. Yeah. Member of a couple of affinity groups that, you know, did a kind of extreme forms of action disruption at various times who, you know, as I said, kind of sees surrealism and as an essential component of the revolutionary, gambit, maybe. Or people like Ted Jones, who is an African-American, for a time, black power activist, certainly very clearly between 67 and 72, FBI profile, everything, was, you know, deeply involved in black power and was an advocate of following Malcolm X of violent direct action and possibly revolutionary overthrow. For him, surrealism was absolutely crucial to that praxis. And it was hard for Jones in particular. You know, I'm writing about him right now. People people both in the new left more broadly and in Black Power, especially Black Panthers, were sort of like, what is, you know, why do we need your poetry here? Sometimes, not all the time, you know, often they understood it, but it didn't always, you know, for these individual stories, right, it has a certain utility and a kind of an essential character. And I'm sorry to keep coming back to surrealism. That's what I write about. But that really helps them. And I think that the SI is doing that too. I mean, they're taking what they need from it. And then they're saying, "What? How are we going to go beyond this to meet the times, you know?" And I will say, I think that what happens in 68 is the closest, you know, I mean, that we have the October Revolution, obviously, in, you know, 17 and 18, and Germany and Russia. But, it, you know, by the late 60s, I think it's like the first time when it's actually like, maybe we can actually do something here if we, you know, there's a broad enough movement that the base could move toward some significant change. So.
But, yeah, I wanted to go back even before this, though, because the sort of neo-surrealism, it seems like it comes up, at least in radical circles in Chicago with the IWW and the rebel worker. And then in New York, with shortly after, with the resurgent youth movement, that's even prior to Ben Maria's phase of political activity.
Yeah, totally. And that's a history that's not well known. And I've been trying to kind of excavate, if you will, and not to like be like, hey, here's a new zine to put in the museum. You know, hey, like,
let's. I mentioned IWW and my black cat hopped right on.
I love your sabotage cat. It's so awesome. Yeah, like that is something that I really maybe kind of finally fully understood, this like broad spectrum of a kind of, I wouldn't say unified radical history, but a kind of connected timeline of radical history to connect a tradition, if you will, or community even, by looking at the Chicago surrealists and reading their stuff and then meeting them. Because they were also doing that work of, like you just said, of connecting early 20th century radicalisms, you know, in the wake of the Haymarket Affair in the 19th century, via like radical publishing, like Charles H. Kerr, which is a publisher that's still going, this group, which eventually calls themselves, some members of them, not all of them, call themselves the Chicago Surrealist Group starting in 66, are like sort of deeply invested in the IWW. So starting in 64 in Chicago as college students, they have a journal called The Rebel Worker, which I believe most issues of are online in PDF form. You can check them out, which is an IWW journal. And, you know, is surrealist right from the get-go, or has like an sort of extensive surrealist components. Some issues are more surrealist than others that lead up to some of the members forming a surrealist group in 66. At the same time, actually it's right after Rebel Worker gets started with what was called the Solidarity Bookshop Group at the time in Chicago. In New York, a young kid, a teenager, a 16-year-old named Jonathan Leake and his brother get their hands on it. It's a zine from Chicago, probably through IWW communities in New York, right, Industrial Workers of the World, and maybe like the Libertarian League and other old left organizations that these young kids are going to, really civil rights in mind, civil rights struggles, getting a hold of it somehow, and then saying, we're going to do the same thing. And this resurgence is this not very well known zine, and I'm applying that word anachronistically in a way, but it really is a zine, mimeographed both of these publications, Rebel Worker and, you know, so early kind of Xerox machine. Resurgence is also an IWW publication, and issue one, right, is also talking about a surrealist outlook. But I just want to say that there are others, like, and this is, I haven't gotten around to doing yet, but there are publications like Front Noir, Black Front, or Black Front Line, maybe you would translate it, in France, which is also connected to the Johnston Forest tendency, that is like, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not only the SI that starting in the late 50s is sort of both intensely critiquing surrealism and then also invoking it. So this journal, Front Noir, as well. You don't see it in other Johnston Forest tendency publications, but because of the Trotsky connection, via Perret in particular and a few other people, Benjamin Perret, the surrealist, there is this, you know, a kind of legacy, if you will, that comes through some of these journals and between from the IWW to Trotskyist Fourth International stuff, that then, like by 66 or, you know, with Black Mask, that's also a zine, is really kind of moving away from a distinctly Trotskyist position and, well, you know, from maybe like the influence of someone like Raya Deniskovaya, who is, sorry if I'm being confusing, but she gives the mimeograph machine to the resurgence group that allows them to print the journal. With Black Mask, right, as you move into the broader New Left or counterculture, those threads become less necessary or even apparent, you know, because it's already there. Like it's there's already a base of a kind of a knowledge that the avant-garde is not only useful in this new struggle, but crucial, which is really interesting.
My take on how this sort of happened, or my impression, is that, you know, the Johnson Forest tendency, I mean, specifically after Hungary, you know, when people are really starting to become disillusioned with Soviet communism, and then, you know, also the 50s are a time of real quietude for the workers' movement, especially in the United States. They begin to reorient towards the, you know, the factory floor, towards, like I said, wildcat strikes, and then also people who are cast out of production increasingly because the deindustrialization that we really connect with the 70s onwards is already beginning various ways. And so there begins to be this focus on the sort of types of rebellions that proletarian people are taking that aren't connected with some big party or some activist movement even, but instead like what young people, young workers are increasingly drawn to do. Like the SNCC, for example, was sort of a youth movement coming out of the 50s civil rights movement and taking new tactics that were, you know, at times contrary to what Martin Luther King proposed. And so I think there was this idea that as the baby boom starts to mature, there's going to be new forms of struggle and avant-garde thinkers, you know, people who are not only interested in avant-garde art from the interwar period, but are interested in the avant-garde of culture, critiquing pop art, or, you know, in the case of the Chicago surrealists, I really like their writings on cartoons like Bugs Bunny and stuff, like looking at what kind of new reality is being constructed post-war and what kinds of struggles are going to come from that. And I think we're still talking about this stuff today because it really did have these premonitions of what 68 would be.
Right. I agree with you that, and this is also why I think this history is really important to study and maybe actually why I really study it in the end, is because if we look at this kind of long history of resistance, like let's say even in just this country or here in maybe Western Europe, you can see that the forms of action or even possibilities for action change. And I have an example moment that I really like, you know, to match your example of the Man Ray object actually getting destroyed and everybody be like, wait, don't do that. Wait, you know, it's really funny. Is that levitating of the Pentagon moment, mm-hmm. which is 67, where, you know, you have the Yippies calling for, you know, kind of a joke, like that you're going to get together and do this prank where you're going to levitate the Pentagon. So all these groups show up. Meanwhile, in the background, Ben Maria of the group called Maria had been involved with the very beautiful magazine Black Mask. Some members of that group become an affinity group called Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker, as I know you know, mm-hmm. UAWMF. Meanwhile, the motherfuckers are doing kind of canvassing the only kind of organizing that they would ever seek to do, which is, you know, saying to people, we're going to actually storm. We're going to get into the Pentagon. And then the resurgence group, these younger teenagers who are really associates of the motherfuckers, the kids, show up too, ready to do it. And so the levitating of the Pentagon is going on. We can see there's footage from Chris Marker that's pretty amazing. The Yippies kind of doing their thing. And then, you know, the action, enough people had gotten the memo. You see this line of people start to move right to the Pentagon and, you know, they do get in. I mean, it's very brief. but they penetrate the Pentagon. And, you know, it just sort of shows this, the sort of convergence of these groups, right? And the way that one tactic might build on another, right? So for the motherfuckers, that's called a breakaway. It's a specific tactic. And the breakaway is brilliant, right? I mean, so we could go right back to like George Sorel writing in the early 20th century in France about the general strike as a kind of uber form of violence. I don't think people would actually think of a general strike as a form of violence today, which is interesting, right? What kind of violence is it? It's a violence against property or against the boss, right? And to some degree, a self-violence against the proletariat, right? They're saying we're not going to get our wages. We're not going to, you know, we're going to be precarious. And
it's really striking against social reproduction itself. I mean,
right. The families. Yeah. So, you know, kind of absorbing that violence, but so like that moment kind of gives a sense of the kind of creativity of praxis. And I do think I would use the word praxis also for actions, like, because they're practical, you know what I mean? You have to think about strategy and like what your actual goal is. And that, but I would say that this is a kind of an avant-garde moment, because of the combination of a kind of performative action, and strategic action that involves, you know, frankly, kind of quite a bit of imagination, right? Of sort of almost impossibility of the purpose of the action. So that it's just a little kind of, you know, thing that I've been thinking about, or but lately I've been thinking about Ted Jones, who starts going to all of these Black Power events in 67. And he's doing surrealist poetry readings at them. Even while he's interested in a Black autonomy of the struggle, in terms of, you know, what Black Power is for him. And it's, you know, he is, so Aimé Césaire of the Negritude movement, also involved in surrealism, is at some of these events. Herbert Marcuse is there. And then you have Ted Jones reading surrealist poetry. It's sort of like, what is this, right? If this is the this is the legacy, or I don't even know, like, that word really, the remainder, the extended tale of the avant-garde that really interests me.
Let's talk a bit about the Surgeon's Youth Movement. You mentioned that they were part of the Pentagon levitation, or break-in in their case. They form around 64 in New York. And again, it kind of reminds me of like a punk movement or a group of punk kids in a lot of ways. So they were really inspired by the IWW and surrealism and the civil rights movement, but they were also infiltrating far-right groups. So they're kind of doing Antifa stuff. They were against alcohol. They made these psychedelic zines that can really only be deciphered by people in their milieu, which is still a major tenet of the punk subculture today, where you like see a flyer and you can't read any of the band names or the location of it intentionally, because they only want people in the know to go. So yeah, tell us a little bit about this group and who they were and what kind of activities they're taking.
Yeah, I just think they're amazing. And when I heard about them, I was like, okay, why am I not really hearing about this? And like, how can I get my hands on these zines? Like, how can I read them? And then how can I make them accessible, you know, help make them accessible to people? And I had first heard about the Resurgence Youth Movement by studying the Chicago Surrealist Group, which forms in 66. And one of the surviving members of that group, Penelope Rosemont, who was deeply connected, you know, to the New Left and counterculture, certainly with the SDS, Students for Democratic Society, but also like Freddie Perlman and the Perlmans and the Black and Red in Detroit, and, you know, many, many other, you know, groups and individuals at that time. She would talk about Jonathan Leake, and in the Rebel Worker, Leake and Leake's compatriot, his comrade, Walter Coy, both published in the Rebel Worker. And then in a way, their journal Resurgence is like a sister or a fraternal journal of Rebel Worker. And then when the Chicago Surrealist Group becomes the Surrealist Group in 66, they have a number of broadside, larger kind of posters where they also publish poetry, specifically surrealist, basically automatic poetry following surrealist writing practices of, in particular, Leake. And So, and then Penelope Rosemont would talk about when Leake came to Chicago in 66 during his LSD period and, you know, tried to do a black mass. You know, it was also an occult period in which, you know, they would have a kind of naked black mask of Penelope on the altar. And I think she was more worried about actually being sacrificed than being, you know, naked in front of a group of occult people on LSD. But I was sort of like, wow. And I was able to see one issue of the journal. And I was most impressed with its intense anti-racism. It's like completely fiery embrace of the riots as the uber revolutionary movements of the 60s, the riots in Harlem and in Newark, but particularly in Harlem. That was actually the reason the journal was founded. It's not surrealism really, or the Chicago group or rebel worker, but it was the 64 riot in Harlem, and they're just condemnation of capitalist white imperialism in 64, which is like pretty early mm-hmm. for white teens, you know, to do this in terms of that kind of rhetoric. I'll just say a little bit about Walter Coy, because it's really interesting. He was a white guy from Texas, middle-class family. Parents were, you know, professional classical musicians, you know, in an orchestra, went to college at Antioch College to study computer science. He's pretty, a little bit older than the Leakes. The Jonathan Leake was the other kind of co-founder, you know, his early 20s, essentially. Meet at Libertarian League in New York, you know, both anarchists. And Coy, while the journal is going on, while the journal resurgence is being produced, the zine is also getting more involved in rent strike activity in New York, helping organize with and alongside in solidarity with the Puerto Rican community. And he is murdered in 1967 in a stairwell of a walk-up, which is still an unsolved mystery, but we don't know who did it.
It seems like it could have been related to the rent strike, you know, taking on the landlord and such.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. I think he was taken out. I totally think he was taken out. Very tragically, his parents both die in a car crash not long after that once. And I just only recently realized that when I did found an obit for Walter. But there's some work that needs to be done there. But that's when the journal stops. I mean, as you can imagine, that would change you. The group is small. It's an affinity group, just like punk. And, you know, Jonathan Leake becomes a punk later on. But the affinity group, which is according to Maria, is a term that was started to be used more aggressively during the Spanish Revolution, is a term that becomes essential in the 60s. I don't know if Leake and crew were using it in 64, but certainly by like maybe 67, the Maria and the motherfuckers were using it. And the idea there is a small group that cannot be infiltrated, that you know the people so well, there's no possibility of infiltration, and you just kind of groove together. Like you love each other. You want to, you're talking all the time, every day, but also you will die for one another in the cause. Right. And that's Maria's definition of it. And so that brings in just the angle of that the resurgence youth movement was a gang as well, like a white gang, if you will, influenced by particularly Puerto Rican gangs. They were in touch with and considered part of certain Latino gangs. There was a big world of that in New York at this time. So not just the old left or really the new left to the hippie counterculture, but also like the gang world, because mm-hmm. they were hoodlums and vandals doing, you know, small time crimes.
And because punks, they also really hated the emerging hippie counterculture. You know, I think a lot of leftists maybe look down on the hippies because there's this mystical aspect to it, the Age of Aquarius and these sort of ill-defined concepts of peace and love and stuff. But they were also into mysticism themselves. Like I think one of their big inspirations was Leake had a dream journal. And that seemed to be as important to their practice as anything else.
And Walter did too. They found under Walter's pillow after his murder, his dream journal was right there under his pillow. They did eventually lose it, but he kept one as well. They're looking for it. They both did. They both wrote automatic poetry that's in both Resurgence and Rebel Worker, and of course there are reprinted Surrealist texts. Yeah. I mean, but this is a good point actually to bring in again, like according to someone like Maria and his comrades in Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker, like the, from what I understand, at least according to Maria, is that the broader movement, yeah, was like the hippie movement was definitely had problems, but that the, you needed the large movement for the smaller, more strategic actions of the affinity group to have any leverage, right? So that's how that works with the Pentagon, right? You canvas with a few key people, and then once people see the line going, right, once the action is happening, they follow. You know, they're ready to spontaneously do that. And so I do think that it depends on who you talk to, that some people would agree that broader movement was needed. I would love to figure out how we can do that now in a way that is sort of just beyond the No Kings thing. Like, you know, because I think many people agree that, I hate to use the word right and left, I find them very problematic terms, but the rights culture is sort of stronger right now in terms of the imagination that it sparks. Mm-hmm. In.
Yeah, I think my affinity with this moment, this like neo-surrealist aspect to it, was that, you know, I keep a dream journal myself, and I recommend everyone do it, because when you keep a dream journal, your dreams become more vivid, and they tell you more complicated stories that are really relevant to your everyday life, and like really give you insight to how part of you, because they come from your brain, right? How part of you feels about what your life is and what's going on, and like people from your life and your past will pop up in different contexts, and this is what the surrealists have always been trying to channel and understand and push into reality for some extent. And I think it's important in any kind of political struggle to understand that, you know, it's not like these aren't just it's not all about critical mass and balance of forces and getting a lot of people to the street and getting them to do what you want them to do. What really pushes a movement farther is new ideas, breaks in the kind of procession of, you know, this is why people don't like No Kings protests, or this is why, for example, the Palestine movement, which was so massive in terms of demonstrations and school occupations and stuff, we don't see much of that now, is because it seemed like it kind of didn't have anywhere to go. It couldn't figure out what else to do exactly. And so people in the early 60s, you know, specifically around 64, where the civil rights movement was sort of reaching one end of its phase, because they got the Civil Rights Act, and like some people were very content with this, and the youth part of the movement was not. Like, you know, this was not, we didn't want these very small reforms and that don't go far enough. We didn't want to elect Johnson. That wasn't the goal of this. And so so I think it's always important to have people who are trying to not only be extremely radical and keep radical principles in mind as we engage in these broader struggles, but also coming up with new ideas about how to push things farther.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was thinking a little bit about Richard Gilman Opolsky's work while you were talking, who talks about the philosopher that talks about sort of in the imagination and revolution. And that kind of goes back to the idea of prefiguration, right? That I, you know, how do you even begin to like live the life you want to live right now, especially right now, this clamping down of authoritarianism and the unbelievable violence that's being wielded upon humans and the natural world by our technology and by our belligerence. And, you know, and so prefiguration would be actually kind of against all odds, you know, maintaining that another way is possible, and that I will live that to the extent that I can, right? Not all of us can be revolutionaries. We have children, we have responsibilities. We can't take a day off, whatever, to go to levitate the Pentagon, you know, but in the various ways that we can, we do it. And then, but then on the, even on the broader level, this is why, you know, for me, like capitalist realism, I have a problem with that term. That idea from Mark Fisher, even though I respect his work greatly, and I think Gilman Opolsky talks about this too to some degree, is I can imagine an end to capitalism. I can imagine a time when we stop states from massacring thousands of people and children and families, you know, and I can imagine a time when I'm not dreaming of the wastelands of Gaza, which is what I do have dreams about now. No, so like,
I do too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like, and yet like there's that despair component, right? Like where it's just like, you know, with the technology they have now, you know, in an instant we could be obliterated right now. And so it's getting harder and yet it's getting scarier too. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
well,
really scary.
I mean, let's remember that we're talking about the '60s. They just were on the brink of annihilation with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that was a hugely influential political moment where the stakes of it rose way higher. Cause you know, people were psyched about Kennedy being elected. It was kind of like an Obama moment. And then a year later, a week goes by where every single moment you're wondering if you were going to die a moment later. This is something that Norman Mailer writes about the influence on, you know, atomic weaponry, sort of changing the cultural atmosphere, making it more intense, making it faster, making it more extreme in various ways. And so I think the kind of cultural intensity and political intensity of the 60s, I think people really yearn for it now. Like, I think people want there to be some kind of avant-garde now. And I think you alluded to this before. It looks like a lot of that energy is on the right in various ways, although maybe it's dying down now. But like the culture that's like well-funded, of course, but also really provocative around neo-reaction and the alt-right and the Silicon Valley elite, this is it draws people in because it seems like they're bracing the future in some way that the left briefly was in like maybe the end of the 10s, but there isn't a lot of hope for the future now. And like the big hope for the future now for the left is like electing social Democrat mayors, which is nice, but you know, it's not really going to save the world in the way that we were thinking about.
Yeah, I really think that like neo-fascists of all kinds and authoritarian racists have studied the left of the 60s in particular very well, and have actually co-opted some of those lessons, and I that's actually a really fascinating subject to try to like actually pinpoint, right? Because of course you see in the media today the use of the word an activist, right, or even radical activist for someone who's a fascist. It's like kind of shocking when I see that. I'm like, wait, what? That word, radical, right? And we know that the right and left, these terms, right, go back to the French Revolution and have to do with the General Assembly and kind of like the spectrum, right? And so you sit on the, so supposedly, you know, the farther you are on the right of the right-hand side of the assembly, you're like a little bit more royalist, but maybe you're more in the middle, you know, so you're a centrist, like in terms of like not, you know, being opposed to either side. And then the farther left you go, right, would be the, you know, you're ready to behead the king at any second, right? So, so much of it comes from the French Revolution. One lesson that I've really learned from talking with Ben Murray extensively over the last few years is the importance of the small affinity group and the power of that. Because and I do agree with Ben that like larger movements and all kinds of organizations, you know, really everything helps, but the small group can kind of do strategic work that doesn't have to be what our government would consider terrorist, right? Like we're not talking about violent direct action here. Other kinds of nonviolent actions that could, you know, be helpful on a basis that is much more rapid. It can be spontaneous and effective and can really kind of aggravate or activate the base of the broader left. So I think that now is the time when, here we are on this other mediated form, but some analog forms and in-person time could really help us. So like to the extent that we can get together in person might become literally the technology that we need to continue to build the movement. I say an anti-technology, if you will.
Yeah, and I'd also add to that, it's very clear to me that we're in a moment where there's deep underground connections being made across the country of people who want to resist ICE. This is, I think, the big political question of this moment that people are rallying around in mass numbers, really. I mean, Minneapolis and Los Angeles showed that, proved that. And wherever ICE goes next, whatever they do next, maybe they're going to stop doing it the way they've been doing it, with these like kind of military invasion surges as a result of being more or less defeated in those places. Maybe they'll move to something a little bit harder to counter. But in those networks of people coming together and really fighting and facing down the police, just in the practical question of defending your neighbors, I think it's important that people come out of those with like some conclusions, like write something, you know, represent it somehow. Like, what did you actually see, you know? You posed the question in your talk at Woodbine about the resurgence youth movement, about how we can think of some surrealist strategies that would help this movement today. And I think maybe the talk didn't really get there, but have you thought anything else about some things that you've seen or some ideas that you have?
Yeah, well, that I was thinking about this phrase called tactical imagination that my friend David Marietta Flores and I have been thinking about. We like that word because it is a little bit more concrete about how, you know, how we can combine maybe kind of an avant-garde, what might be called an avant-garde approach to experimental creative action activity, you know, with something practical. So again, kind of speaking to that kind of perennial problem of theory versus praxis. And I have never seen too much of a divorce in that. Like, I really like studying early 20th century texts coming out of socialism and anarchism, like Emile Puget's Le Sabotage, which theorizes sabotage, but also, you know, discusses as a form of praxis, as a form of resistance. And again, there are many species of sabotage that, you know, of all different kinds. Most of us do sabotage on some, you know, daily level, which is usually kind of stealing time from the job. And I mean, basically, how do you live and with 9-to-5s or the more than 9-to-5s that we have these days, if you're not actually stealing time? I mean, we can barely get through, right? We're barely making it with, you know, the price of keeping up with the market these days. I mean, I think that is a horizon, and I think it is speculative. And I really have come to respect this idea that action needs to mutate and possibly mediate or shift within the moment. And so that kind of nowness of relevant action, I think, can never be underestimated, right? So kind of formulas could be problematic, especially since you don't want to dictate action to people who have all different kinds of abilities and possibilities. And also what we're up against is constantly changing and is certainly getting more and more dangerous by the minute. I mean, depending on who you are, if you're in Palestine, basically, I mean, the limit is already reached of bare life. So, you know, in the United States, also depending on who you are, right, the level of danger is shifting constantly. And we might not even realize to what degree. So, but to try to answer your question more directly, I mean, I guess what I would be interested in people thinking about and kind of going back to Deleuze is like the little voices that we have in our head, the like private moments of like thought before we go to bed or when we wake up, or the dream that you had, you know, let's say about violence of some kind, or, you know, that actually could, that listening to that can be catalytic on a daily lived basis for what actually, how this is impacting our lives in the plural. Like, I, you know, are we okay with our lifetime? This is it. That's all we have. Are we okay with this happening? You know, what are we going to do about it? And so, like, that little voice for me is never leaves me alone. And it's hard, you know, and I'm here, I'm a white middle-class American. You know, I'm safe. But what I mean is, I think that the surrealist aspect of the avant-garde would have you listen to that voice and have that be a catalyst for some kind of action, even on the micro level. Mm. So micro-political actions, like following Deleuze again.
Yeah, I mean, I think that voice is what does ultimately mobilize masses of people who realistically should be terrified. You know, people in Minneapolis gave up, you know, the people who were killed, they knew that they had the chance of being shot in the street, and they went out and did it anyway to defend their neighbors. And one tactic that I saw emerging from that was the roundabouts. Did you see those?
Yeah, in terms of like having like blockades of certain kinds.
Yeah, there would be sort of these road blockades where it would force the cars to kind of drive around them and give the people at the blockades a chance to scan the license plate to see if they were ICE vehicles.
Yeah.
And that seemed like it kind of really was starting to form at the kind of end of this ICE surge. And it was very controversial online. A lot of people who supported the movement against ICE says, don't do this, you know? But that was definitely the site of something very new, or a new tactic.
Yeah.
And new,
I see. Right. Yeah. Actual. Like, I agree.
And of course, building barricades is always artistic in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really. I mean, to study that, really to get a kind of typology of the different, adaptations of what could be done in the moment. This is what I mean. I mean, and essentially, we're talking about battle tactics. I mean, right? Like, in a sense, street. Like guerrilla battle tactics, and I think that there are cultural guerrilla battle tactics as well. But a lot of that would arise in the moment to sort of see what's needed. And I think that kind of instinctive. I think instinct is also really important at this point. Instinctive creativity, you know, about how you're gonna resist, letting your neighbors be pulled away or you being pulled away or whatever. I mean, there's a lot that can be done there, and I don't want to prescribe any of that. But that is, I mean, it's, I think it's a basic human characteristic, right? To be able to think on your feet, make tools, and create reactions and strategies. So I think that's something that's, you know, thinking about the proletariat or just everyday people, it's already there. And I have full confidence that people will continue to, you know, do that. But, you know, maybe for like whatever, knowledge workers or creative workers or artists, if you will, you know, I think that there's a whole nother level of things that could be done, not just in the moment of the struggle, but in that kind of afterthought or beforethought that you were talking about, that could be incredibly helpful. I'm not an artist myself, but, you know, I think that playing with that temporality a little bit could offer some really wonderful movement building strategies. And I do think that morale, you know, questions of morale, questions of solidarity, cohesiveness, the social aspects, visual imagination, and all of that helps.
I'll ask you another question. You're located in Portland, right? So another anti-ICE tactic that's been getting a lot of play online. I try not to judge these things because I'm not there. But people talk a lot about the frog block, and then there was like a furry protest, like a furry yoga protest. And these sort of went viral on the right, but then also on the left, so people saying, don't do this. And I'm not going to ask you to weigh in on that, but it does seem like there is a reaction to things that are new and unfamiliar or surreal, maybe, where people say, oh, this isn't serious enough. Like, you're degrading the seriousness of this movement by doing this. And my reaction is like, maybe I don't like the way this looks, but the real question is it working? Is it tactically moving the goal forward in some way? And I've seen, like, you know, that stuff is not entirely new. Like, there's been sort of radical clowns at protests for years, and that people are often very annoyed by, but I have seen them at moments like distracting police, and like it, as the fact that a clown is like bothering a police officer makes it much less likely the cop is going to beat up a clown, and maybe will like sort of take the pressure off the rest of the march in some way as like a diversionary tactic or something.
Yeah, totally. Which, by the way, détournement, that word, its first life is as a form of diversion, right? So in a military diversion where you put the, you know, put the troops going one way and then you actually do the real attack from the behind. The diversion is a crucial tactic. And, you know, I mean, I personally think that everything helps right now, that anything is needed. You know, I'm not a tactical expert on civil disobedience, but, you know, I can see the other arguments, but I believe that the more is the better right now. So, you know, and especially if we're talking about building a broad movement, a movement that would have, of course, multiple tiers, that would have, of course, different factions, you know, that ideally were to some degree able to not certainly not cohere, but in needed moments coalesce. I mean, like the New Left, right? I mean, a New Left is like totally imperfect. And so is the history of artistic avant-garde. You know, but I think at this point we need to try to find, you know, I mean, maybe I'm practical in this way, but, you know, to think about what can help. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, people have asked me, you know, is the Dancing Frog or the Stuffies in Portland where you are like an example of a kind of surrealist resistance? I think it could be considered that. The use of humor, of course, as a tactic is really important. I would love to know the long history of protest clowns. I don't know that. And I'm sure it goes back to the revolution, the French Revolution. I mean, there's lots of revolutions, let's just be clear. But I mean the French one. But I think, you know, that I think actually even the notion of a strike or of sabotage, if you look at sabotage, there's like all of these different types of it, as I said, like maybe 50 different kinds of sabotage. They all have names and depending on which culture, you know, and that's just sheer creativity. You know, that's like the proliferation of like, hey, you know, how can I pull the wool over the boss's eyes and not get caught or not maybe lose my job and yet still make this work for me just as I'm working for them, right? The resistance that is necessary for survival within the capitalist sphere or for lives that are not, you know, just purely exploitative, right? So certainly in the early 20th century, that was more the case. So you know, but I can see that there would be critiques. And certainly there's this question of defense. I mean, you know, there's a reason the spray is coming right up the mask of the frog, right? And you're bringing your kids to the protest, right? We were, the Portland families, children, pets were just tear gassed for doing, you know, peaceful, legal protest.
And, oh yeah. You know, and you also mentioned the use of umbrellas since 2020. And that's as a way of, you know, deflecting tear gas or pepper spray or anonymizing. And the umbrella is an old Dadaist symbol, you know.
Totally. Yeah, and I don't know if you've seen this, like saw a post about a kind of homemade defense tactics, like where you're taping hardback books to yourself to create a shield, your body, you know, and then using the umbrella. I have to find this sort of this, but like, you know, go to Home Depot, get some tape. Get your books, like get your whatever hardcover, you know, Communist Manifesto and tape it to yourself. And I guess not the manifesto, that's too thin. Let's maybe Das Kapital, a couple of volumes, you know, and, you know, to create shield, you know, and I mean, obviously there are sonic issues. I mean, there's a million ways we could be hurt right now. And obviously the technology is only growing. So, you know, in that regard, it truly is already, I mean, this is dystopian to like the fullest extent, obviously. Right. And the possibilities
I think
there
it could get fuller. I think we might see it get fuller. Well, let me ask you to close it out. Let's go back to art. We started with art. Let's close it out with art. Who are some surrealist artists or some surrealist projects today that you like?
Interesting. Like with current living surrealists today. Yeah, it's a great question. Right now, it appears that with contemporary surrealists, and there are different groups around the world, that actually the things that inspired me the most are coming from individuals who are really, and sometimes small groups, tapping into that uncompromising, liberationist, resistant strategy of refusal. And in such a way that it actually is mostly kind of linked to a rhetoric of condemnation of various regimes and genocidal things that we're seeing in the world, right? And so the use of the manifesto the use of small group communication and active protest, activism of various kinds, both on the broader movement level and on the individual level, I seem really important to me. I'm very inspired by the writing of Michael Lowy, who was formerly a member of the Paris Surrealist group since the 70s and is currently a member of the Chicago Surrealist group. And Michael comes from a Trotskyist background, but is also not, someone who is shying away from anarchist perspectives, historical and contemporary, taking a kind of long view theoretically and politically in terms of social movement change, about what this means for us as people, about what's happening now, but also surrealism. So surrealist praxis, that is, I realize I'm not really talking about art here. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about thinkers and writers, and I could talk a little bit about art, but I have to be honest, that would be harder for me. I would not place creative praxis, and apologies to my surrealist comrades, in the realm of what we might call visual art right now. That would be something that would be the most exciting for me in terms of at least responding to what I think is urgent, which is what is happening to them and us, what is happening who are the 3,800 children who are incarcerated by ICE right now, and the multiple centers that are being built by this government, the U.S. dollars that are being built to create new bombs, millions of dollars, billions, I think, actually recently, to create new weapons for Israel as they begin to mass execute prisoners, including minors. What else is there to, what are we thinking about here? So, this is the critic in me that is, if we're not talking about that in our art or actions, I don't really think it's very relevant. So I would have to go beyond contemporary.
Part of the reason I want to talk to you is, I recently moved to downtown Manhattan. I'm in this like gallery area, and I go to the galleries, and some things I like and some things I don't, but I kind of want to challenge myself to be a better art critic or a better art appreciator. This is an ongoing process, because I feel like TJ Clark still does great art writing, and Grill Marcus as well. And so I'm just trying to follow some interesting critical threads, I guess, for the
visual
arts.
The work of Waleed Rod, a Lebanese artist. I think he's really important. I'm very interested in people who maybe aren't always making visual work, we're connected to this realist movement and very politicized. So I there are a lot of artists who are working right now who interest me. I'm really interested in Lillian Lin's work as well, who has some connections to surrealism. But I wouldn't say that that is the strength of surrealist groups today in terms of the visual.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. I'll throw in one other art group that you might be interested in. I'll send you the link to it. They're the Schizo Feminists in New York, who are very interested in surrealism and have done some interesting performance art outside Jeffrey Epstein's mansion in the Upper East Side, trying to draw connections to Epstein, rape culture, and then also the kind of that world that still exists in the downtown scene.
Fantastic.
I won't talk too much about them because I'm hoping to get them on the show soon.
Great.
But thanks a lot for your time. We covered a lot of ground. Hopefully it was fun for the listeners.
Super great. Thanks, Andy. Yeah. And I'll send you that name, and have a great day, okay?
Okay, you too.
Take care. See you soon. Let's stay in touch.
Good night.
Okay, bye.